Welcome to our second podcast interview with Dr. Pamela Line. In our first Census Pod episode with Dr. Line, she spoke generally about the link between environmental factors and autism spectrum disorders. I had the opportunity to introduce her to our audience then, and I would like to do that again now. Dr. Pamela Line earned her Bachelor's of Science degree in biology from Cornell University. She also has a Master's of Science degree in Environmental Health Sciences from East Tennessee State University in Johnson City, Tennessee. Finally, she earned her PhD in Pharmacology and Toxicology from the University of Buffalo in New York. Dr. Line received her postdoc training in molecular immunology at the Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo. She is currently a professor of neurotoxicology and chair of the Department of Molecular Biosciences in the School of Veterinary Medicine at the University of California, Davis. In addition, she holds a faculty appointment in the UC Davis Mind Institute. Census Cultural has a long institutional partnership with the UC Davis Mind Institute, and we're very pleased to have Dr. Line join us today. Welcome again, Dr. Line. We are delighted to have you join us for our second podcast interview. For this second podcast episode, I plan to get into more details about this crucial topic. Can you please list the top three pollutants that contribute to autism spectrum disorders?
That is a really good question, and I wish we really had a definitive answer to that question. But the truth is, this is an evolving field, and it's very clear that a variety of environmental toxicants might actually contribute to autism depending upon the genetic substrate of the individual that's exposed. So I guess to answer your question and give some shape to it, that when we look at the epidemiologic studies that have been published, as well as the experimental animal and mechanistic studies that have been published, there's sort of three categories of environmental chemicals that keep popping up again and again. And so I would say that these are really, there's good evidence to suggest that they are environmental risk factors for autism. And these include traffic-related air pollution, or air pollution maybe in general, not clear if it's the particulate matter in the air pollution or if indeed it is the gases in the air pollution or a mixture of both, but very clearly traffic-related air pollution or near roadway exposure is another term that's used. Has been strongly associated with increased risk for autism. And there are now mechanistic studies that have shown that in experimental animals, where we can really control the exposures, that exposure during development, during brain development, to traffic-related air pollutants will indeed cause adverse outcomes that have similarity to the types of changes in both behavioral and structural that we see in patients with autism. The second major category of environmental chemical that we see associated with increased risk for autism time and time again, and I should note there are exceptions to all these studies. There actually have been also studies that have not found an association, but the predominant number of studies have shown an association, would be pesticides. And this includes both the organophosphate pesticides as well as the pyrethroids and potentially the organochlorine pesticides. So pesticides are a very large group of chemicals that are defined functionally as chemicals that kill pests, insect or otherwise. But they also typically are working through effects on the nervous system, and many of them have been shown to be developmental neurotoxicants in animal models and in humans. A prime example of this would be chlorpyrifos, which was outlawed or banned for residential use in the state of California a number of years ago, and was just recently banned nationwide by the US EPA. And then the third category, a broad category of chemicals that we see have strong association with autism risk, include what I'm going to refer to as the persistent organic pollutants. So these are typically man-made compounds, but not always, but many of them are man-made. And they are organic, meaning they have a carbon backbone, and they're persistent in the environment, hence the name persistent organic pollutants. And this includes the brominated flame retardants, such as polybrominated diphenyl ethers, or PBDEs, as well as the polychlorinated biphenyls or PCBs. Again, epidemiologic data links subsets of these chemicals to increased risk for autism in humans, and we have a pretty rich history of experimental data saying that they will interfere with brain development.
Well, thank you for that answer. What steps are governments and countries in general taking, to your knowledge, to reduce these environmental pollutants?
So there are a number of approaches that are being taken at many levels of organization. So approaches are being taken at the community level, at the regional level, state level, and of course federal level. And efforts do differ between the United States and countries in Europe or Asia, for example. So I'd say that Europe, actually, the EU, is a little bit more progressive perhaaps than the United States, but the United States is very active in this regard as well. And so a lot of the steps that are being taken, and many of these have been in place for a long time, for example, such as the steps to minimize lead in the environment, are to try and pass regulatory policies to reduce the use of these types of chemicals in consumer products or in places where children would typically reside, and also to regulate the levels that are present in the environment. A few chemicals have been outright banned. We talked about the chlorpyrifos example a second ago. And of course, we know that lead is banned from use in gasoline, for example, here in the United States. So these are the types of steps that are being taken. I'm not really aware of any legislation that's been passed specifically with autism in mind. But again, the developing brain is a target of concern for many regulatory policies. And so I think the general practice is to think that anything that protects the brain will also be helpful in mitigating exposures that may increase risk to autism.
What are the top national and international initiatives or bodies that raise awareness about and take some form of action to reduce the environmental pollutants that contribute to ASD?
Well, here in the United States, that would predominantely be the United States Environmental Protection Agency, otherwise referred to as the US EPA. And then here in California, we actually have a very progressive government agency as well, which is the California Environmental Protection Agency, or Cal EPA, as it's referred to. There are other similar agencies in other states. For example, there's a fairly progressive agency in the state of New York and the state of Massachusetts and other states around the country that take action in trying to prevent exposures of the developing brain or children to these types of environmental contaminants.
Is there a link between greenhouse gas emissions and the rise of pollutants causing these contaminants and in general, pollutants that contribute to ASD?
Yes, absolutely. So two prime examples would be, number one, the increase in these greenhouse gases is basically increasing wildfires, the risk of wildfires, which are releasing both persistent organic pollutants and, of course, air pollutants into the environment that have been linked to autism spectrum disorders. Because of the increase in greenhouse gases, we also see that traffic-related air pollutants are persisting in areas for longer periods of time, so their concentrations are building up. And so we see a lot of links between greenhouse gases and air pollution. And of course, as I indicated earlier, air pollution, or in particular traffic-related air pollution, is a strong risk factor for autism. The other example, which is of concern, is that there's a strong link between greenhouse gas emissions and the release of these persistent organic pollutants from glaciers at the poles. So many of these persistent organic pollutants, because they're persistent in the environment, will cycle around the globe. So they're carried by water, they're carried by air currents, and a lot of them had settled at very high concentrations in the polar ice caps. Again, this is another reason that we see very high concentrations of these contaminants in the flesh of polar animals, such as polar bears, and in the populations, human populations that live in these Arctic regions, so Eskimo Inuits, for example. Now, with the increase in greenhouse gas, of course, these glaciers and these snows are melting, and that's releasing persistent organic pollutants back into global circulation. And we do see an increase in their concentrations in areas that are closer to the equator. So they are moving again through the environment, and the concentrations are building up. So all these contaminants that have been sequestered for many, many years are now being re-released into global circulation.
Thank you for that response. What do you think organizations such as Census Cultural can do to raise awareness about these issues, greenhouse gas emissions, their impact on autism, and especially in forums such as the recent UN climate conference, COP26, that was held in Glasgow recently in 2021?
That's a great question. So I think there are a number of things that could be done. One, for example, is having podcasts like this to bring in individuals with different perspectives on this issue to raise awareness in your listeners. So that's very helpful. The other thing I think is for Census Cultural and other similar organizations to provide the tools to their listeners to really organize and lobby the regulatory agencies and our various elected officials to really make this an issue of concern, to really push the priority to think about this. So for example, at COP26, there are a number of advocacy groups that were there to remind the people who were involved in making the decisions that came out of COP26 that these issues have impacts that are really widespread and include our future generations, our children. So protecting the minds of our future generations, I think, is a really important reason to really pursue the difficult task of trying to control greenhouse gases and global warming. And so I think, you know, becoming citizen advocates is going to be a really crucial part of seeing remediation of these various concerning trends that are happening right now in our world. And so I think that would be very important. And then I think having Census Cultural work with experts to develop materials to provide their listeners with the tools. So the podcasts are a great start, but also perhaps a website that could act as a clearinghouse with information to help listeners evaluate the evidence and then determine steps to move forward with it.
Thank you very much for sharing some very good ideas with us. And we appreciate your support for our podcast program and look forward to perhaps implementing a few of the very good ideas that you just spoke about. We were really delighted to have this morning with you, and thank you very much again for joining this second podcast episode of Census Pod. It was a pleasure to have you.
It's been my pleasure to participate, and if there's any questions that come up on the part of your listeners after the fact, I'm happy to try and resolve them or point them in the right direction for information that might be of use.
Thank you for being so generous with your time. We look forward to speaking to you very soon again.
Well, thank you for hosting me. I really appreciate the opportunity, and I would be delighted to answer any follow-up questions that your listeners may have. They can reach out to me through my email, which is available on the website. So good luck to you. Continue in your great work, and it was a real pleasure.